The field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train. Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, every week, all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. Mike Pena, Jude Feld, our producer Lee Delapina, with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios and ready to rock and roll for the next hour here on this Wednesday evening. And JT, another outstanding edition of Trainer Talk forthcoming. Two tremendous guests. The first, who needs really no introduction, he's very familiar to almost every racing fan. That's trainer John Service. He's going to join us in the first half of the show. And then Steve Hobby will be here in the second half. And, of course, Steve earning his 1,000th career victory just at the beginning of the month and then coming back with Tiz Miss Sue defending her title in the Azari this past weekend. So looking forward to hearing from Steve and hearing about his career as well.
Yeah, I love these shows. I love hearing how trainers got their start, what makes them love the game so much, and it's a lot of fun.
We do welcome everybody back that has been with us for the past 3 hours from 3 to 6 Eastern with our live race coverage on XM Channel 209, and a very special welcome to all of you just joining us on Sirius Channel 93 for this final furlong Trainer Talk edition here on Wednesday evening. And without further ado, we bring in John Service, the 54-year-old who grew up in the shadows of Charlestown Racetrack in West Virginia. He has recorded 1,322 victories to date and had that magical run in 2004 with Smarty Jones winning the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness before coming up just short in that Triple Crown bid in the Belmont Stakes. John, nice enough to be with us here tonight. John, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you on board, and welcome to Trainer Talk, and can't wait to, we'll talk about Smarty Jones. I'm sure that's going to come up over the course of the next 20 or 25 minutes, but can't wait to hear about your story and how you got started. I mentioned growing up next to Charlestown, I guess maybe a mile from Charlestown in rural West Virginia. Tell us about growing up around the racetrack and how you got started.
Well, Charlestown was still very, very small when I was a child there growing up. My high school was a county high school, so the whole county went to one high school. And I was probably about less than a quarter of a mile from Charlestown Racetrack when I grew up, and every opportunity we got, you know, we would go over and sit on the hill as kids and watch the horses break out of the gate and run around the racetrack, and you know, I just fell in love with it. And my dad, being an ex-rider and now a steward, you know, we were kind of following a little bit, my brother and my sisters and I, and you know, I told my dad early on that I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I kept hounding him and kept hounding him. And finally, at 14, he got me a job on a breeding farm for the summer. And, you know, his theory was if you were going to be around horses, you were going to learn from the ground up. So you learn to respect, you know, the thoroughbred. And I started out mucking stalls there and actually progressed a little bit, went from mucking stalls to weeding gardens, and finally into the foaling period when we started dropping some foals, and then that's when it got real exciting, and I knew I was in love with it then. And then I went back to high school, and the following summer, I actually galloped horses at Audley Farm in Virginia. And then when the summer after that, when I was 16, I got on the racetrack, and the gentleman that I worked on the farm for when I was 14 actually gave me a job at the racetrack, walking horses and learning how to groom, and the guy named Frank Gall and from O'Sullivan Farms, and his main trainer, which was right underneath to him, a fellow by the name of Gene Smith, were probably the two guys that were the most instrumental in getting me started in the horse business and teaching me how to work on legs and how to work around horses. And And you know, all the grooms that worked with him, you know, helped me along also. And I'm talking back, you know, early 70s at Charlestown. I remember I was telling a couple guys that worked for me the other morning, we were talking, the first set of ice boots that I ever used on a horse were made out of corduroy pants.
And, wow.
And they would just, you know, they would just take the bottom of the pants and slit holes in them, run them up over the horse's hoofs, put baling twine through them, tie them tight, and then get a piece of cotton or a fleece or something to put over their back and a pair of suspenders and hook them to one side of the pants over top to the other side. You know, naturally just cut the legs off and then just fill them with ice, and the corduroy would hold them in pretty well.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that you learn at smaller racetracks that don't have big purses and fancy horses. You really learn how to take care of horses, and you learn a lot about horses' problems. It's a great way to start, and obviously you learned your lessons well, but that kind of stuff's irreplaceable as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah, and you know, for the money that they were running for, they didn't have a lot of money to spend on a veterinarian and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, you know, when you went in to do a horse up, if you came out of that horse, I mean, if you came out of that stall within 35, 40 minutes after going in to do him up, the trainer would tell you, get your butt back in there. You're not done. You get to rub it on there. Pull them bandages back off. And sometimes they didn't even get bandages. We'd just go in there and slap some alcohol on their legs and just rub them down real well. Sometimes we just rub them down. We'd spend 20 minutes rubbing their legs down and wouldn't put any medicine on them.
Yeah.
Just to get the circulation going.
Yeah, and you know, and you mentioned your dad being a jockey, and then, of course, now a steward. He was the manager of the Jockeys Guild for, 11 years. And is that initially, John, where you thought maybe that was going to be your calling, to be a jockey?
No, I was never really small enough to do that. I even when I galloped horses, I was around 135, 140 pounds, you know, younger. My brother, however, now, he wanted to be a jockey in the worst way. And when he graduated from high school, he actually made a very good attempt to try to get his weight down and ride, and was actually pretty decent. But I can tell you, his senior year in high school, he fought hard to get down to wrestle 112 pounds, and the following year he was a jockey tacking, you know, 108, 110.
Wow.
And I knew there was no way he was going to be able to do it. And thank God my uncle, my dad's brother, was his agent at Monmouth Park. And, you know, he called my dad and said, you know, this kid's killing himself. He can't do it. He just can't do it anymore. So Jason ended up quitting riding and became an assistant trainer. And now he's one of the top trainers on the East Coast.
Now, is he your younger brother? Is that right?
He's my older brother.
Okay. All right. So did you kind of somewhat follow in his footsteps too, or were you already training when he decided to be a trainer?
No, I was already training. Jason's only been training for about 10 years, I guess.
Okay.
Believe it or not, I got my first – I didn't get my trainer's license until 84, but I bought my first horse for $325 that I saved up from my junior and senior year of high school working, plus my graduation money, and went and bought a horse for a ham sandwich that believe it or not, turned into a profit. I bought this horse. I brought him home from Monmouth Park, and I was so proud of him. And there was a trainer at Charlestown named Wayne Kent, and I respected him very much. And I went over and said, Wayne, you got to come see this horse I bought. He's awesome. You know, you're going to love him. And he finally made his way over there, and he was a big guy. He never even got out of the truck. You know, and he says, bring that horse out, boys. So I bring the horse out, and I parade him up and down. He says, did you feed this horse yet? And I said, yeah, I fed him. Why do you say that? He goes, don't put another oat in him. I go, why? He goes, you're not going to make a penny with this horse. He goes, get rid of him. You don't have a prayer with him. And I was so dejected. I was like, oh, my God. You know, this is my first horse. I love him. You know, and I think he was $325 or $350. And the next morning, I was walking around the barn. I still remember his name. His name was Mr. Spaceman. And there was a trainer on the other side. and he's a big gray horse. I think the guy wanted him for a jumper because he said, "You want to sell that horse?" I said, "Sure, I'll sell him." He goes, "Would you take $500 for him?" I said, "You bet." I sold him the next day for $500, and that was my start into the training game.
You might have should have quit right then, huh? That's great. That's a great story. Well, you know, you can get in the game for a little bit of money at some of those smaller tracks, and it really helps the learn by doing method in horse racing is really the way to go, I think. I mean, you can work for other people, but it's when you have your name on the program and it's your horse and you're calling the shots, it's a whole different kettle of fish.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and you have, and you know, for me, especially, you know, from my dad, you know, with all he went through riding and then, you know, manager of the Guild for 11 years and then became a state steward in West Virginia and then also a steward at Monmouth and in Pennsylvania. And, you know, and my uncle being a jockey's agent, you know, we kind of built up a pretty good reputation with the name. So, you know, that's very important to the service family. And my brother and I both, I mean, we work very hard at you know, keeping that reputation squeaky clean and try to, you know, try to keep the name great out there. And it's worked out good for us.
John Service, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
I read where you and your brother often bounce things off one another. How much fun is that to have somebody that you're so close to be able to, you know, discuss your stables and stuff?
Well, it's fun. I mean, we don't get in depth over stuff, but we'll talk about horses that we've had or different things we've done. And it's kind of funny because, you know, none of us ever really watched the other one train, but my brother and I, and even my brother-in-law, Eddie Pleasa, we kind of have some of the same methods of training, you know, just reading between the lines on some of the things that we do, you know, as far as putting a lot of, you know, a lot of distance in a horse and getting a good bottom under him and stuff like that. But most of the time we're talking about, you know, form on horses or certain races we watched, or, you know, with my dad, especially being an ex rider and a steward, a lot of times we'll talk about a race and, you know, certain things jockeys did that we thought maybe they should have done different, or what they did that we thought was an exceptional thing, you know, that kind of thing. But, at some point in the dinner conversation, it always gets around to horse racing, that's for sure.
Well, and you mentioned he wrestled in high school. Was he the athlete in the family, John, or did you play some other sports as well?
No, we both wrestled. We both wrestled. That was both of our big sports. Neither one of us were really big enough to do anything else. Both of us played baseball, but didn't really play much in high school because, you know, we were working. That was the other great thing about being in a small town. You could go to work at the racetrack and work there in the morning and get to school by 9:30, and, you know, you were good to go, especially your senior year, depending on how many credits you needed. So we were getting up at 4:30 going to the racetrack before we even went to school. And my brother and I both did that. I mean, that was part of growing up for us.
What position did you play in baseball?
I played center field and caught, and Jason played shortstop and second base.
If I ask him, who's he going to say was better?
Well, you know, he's older, so you know he's going to say he was better. You just remind him that he's the oldest one.
Yeah, you played longer than he did, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, believe I'm the older brother as well, and my brother and I have a great rivalry. We're both very competitive. We both grew up playing sports, and it's still like that. It carries over now to the golf course. Do you have that sibling rivalry with your brother? Do you still kind of needle each other a little bit?
No, we really don't.
Yeah.
We, you know, Jason's big thing, other than the horses, is probably being out in the water, fishing, and for me, that's not a big love of mine. So, you know, there's really not much. He doesn't play golf anymore or anything like that, so there's not much we do other than the horse racing. And yeah, quite honestly, we know how tough it is, and you know, there's no need to be needling either one of us, because you know, we know how hard we work and how tough it is to maintain a steady percentage. And so that really doesn't come into play.
You mentioned one of the hallmarks of the service family training regimen is long works and having a horse fit. Your brother-in-law, Eddie Pelisa, put a mile work into It's My Lucky Day the other day, and a lot of people were buzzing about it like it was something strange. I grew up with, you know, trainers like Charlie Whittingham and those guys that used to work horses a mile and 138 all the time. It didn't really seem all that odd to me. What do you make of the situation now where most guys only work a horse a half a mile, maybe a few 5/8, and then run them?
Well, I think a lot of it's the mentality that this day and age that we're in. You know, we got kind of caught up in the error of speed, and you know, I don't want to single-handedly blame anybody, but when Wayne Lucas came into the game and you know, made such an impact, a lot of his great horses were young horses with brilliant speed, and even the breeding industry, between that and the sales, really started gearing themselves, you know, towards speed. And so I think a lot of trainers nowadays are still concentrating on that. As far as the breeding end of it, I think they're starting to get away from that. They're trying to get back to that, you know, that long distance, big boned horses that will stay a lot sounder. But, you know, and to go back to my brother and Eddie and I, you know, I mean, we're not exactly alike. Don't get me wrong. I mean, Eddie breeds a horse a mile. I'm not sure exactly how Jason does it, but I know he does it. And for me, I'll breeze one a mile here and there. But my big thing is I like to see, you know, every so many days or so, I'll put like a 150 mile, 148 mile into a horse, you know, just to keep a good bottom in him and get, you know, get some air in him. And it's just, I guess it's old school. You know, a lot of guys did that when I was growing up, and I've had some success doing that. It's worked good for me.
Well, John, I want to make sure that we take a little time and walk down memory lane a little bit with you and take a look at the Smarty Jones run through the Triple Crown before we run out of time here during this segment. And I thought it would be nice to kind of look back on maybe the signature moment of your entire career.
They head for home. Lionheart set down to a full-out drive. The outside, here comes Smarty Jones. Smarty Jones, Lionheart digs in gamely. Smarty Jones pushing on by. Smarty Jones is taking the lead. Lionheart tough as nails. Smarty Jones is going clear. The unbeaten colt, Smarty Jones, is drawing away to win the Derby. Smarty Jones and Stewie Elliott going on to win. Smarty Jones goes on to win the Kentucky Derby in that big bonus by 2.5. Lionheart ran second, and finishing third was Imperialism, then Limehouse.
Late, great Luke Kriposch with the call of Smarty Jones winning the 2004 Kentucky Derby. And, John, just curious, when you hear that call, what goes through your mind?
Oh, gosh, that was incredible. You know, just talking with you now, reminiscing about my brother and stuff, I remember after congratulating Chappie and Mrs. Chapman and everything and walking out of the box heading to the winner's circle, the first person that grabbed me was my brother, and he was so emotional and just really was really caught up in it. And you know, it was a special moment. I had my boys with me. My wife was with me. You know, my two sons walked over with me with the horse, and my mom and dad were there. And it was a very special time, very special.
You know, for people who have never had the opportunity, and there's been the majority of people have never had that opportunity that you've had to be sitting there watching the horse that you train, or even a horse that somebody owns, burst through, take the lead in the Kentucky Derby down the stretch. Describe that moment when you finally realize you're going to win the Kentucky Derby.
Well, I guess I'm a little superstitious because I'm one of those guys that doesn't show a lot of emotion until they're at the wire, because I don't want to throw any more weight on that horse's back than he needs. He's already got a jockey there, and I was always kind of like, you know, if I start rooting for him, that's more, you know, putting more pressure on the horse. And it was kind of a stupid thought, but I mean, that's always the way I've been. So watching the race, I was trying to remain very subdued, and in the last 70 yards when he was drawn away, I just kind of put my arm up and don't know if it really sunk in until later on. I mean, because everything was happening so fast, and you know, later that evening we were sitting around. I was like, Kentucky Derby. I mean, it's overwhelming. Even more so afterwards, heading into the Preakness. But when they're coming through the stretch and you see your horse taking the lead, I don't know if it gets much better than that.
Do you go back and watch the race much anymore?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How often?
I would say probably a couple times a year. Every once in a while, I'll pop it up and I'll watch it just to have a flashback. And I'll watch the Preakness, too. Needless to say, I won't watch the Belmont, but I will watch the Preakness and the Derby.
Yeah, talk about the highest highs and the lowest lows. You go on, you win the Preakness, you come to the Belmont. Everybody's having smarty parties. The horse sweeps the nation. An awful lot of pressure on you going into that Belmont Stakes. Talk about that experience.
Well, you know, that it's funny because going into the Kentucky Derby, you know, my horse was doing great. I mean, I knew he was a good horse. He'd worked tremendous for the race. And the only thing I was a little concerned about was how he would be going over to the paddock, because I elected not to school him in the paddock. You know, I was kind of going to go with the element of surprise and hope that would do it for us, and which it did. I mean, he came over like a perfect gentleman and was great the whole time. So I felt really, really confident going into the Derby, going into the Preakness the same way. I mean, I just felt so good about him. And I'll tell you, I felt great about him until they put Eddington and Rock Hard 10 were both in the same barn with me. And I remember sitting in the barn the morning they shipped in, and I watched those two horses walk in the barn, and I was like, oh, my God. They're both twice the size of my horse. And I'm like, oh. But my horse was doing great. I felt super about it, and he ran awesome. And you know, it was weird because there were so many things that were signs going into the Derby and going into the Preakness that were all positive signs that you know, were leading to the wins. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff. And then the Belmont was just the opposite. It was like little things that would happen that you think, this isn't good. You know, like just as an example, the morning of the Belmont, I'm on my way to the barn, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, and I had a flat tire.
Oof.
And I'm like, oh, man, this is not a good omen, you know. Belmont Day, I got a flat tire, and, you know, little things like that. And there was a lot of media things that I did. And there was one interview I did with a reporter in Philadelphia, and they were asking about, you know, what makes Belmont so tough? Is it the distance? And I mentioned to him, I said, well, it is the distance. It's the timing. But the biggest thing is if you've won the first two legs, the third leg, I don't care who you are, you have a bullseye on your back. Everybody knows you're the horse to beat.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is going into the race. And I remember after the interview walking away, and my wife came up to me and she said, you know, when you said that, I got the sickest feeling in my stomach. Mm. She said, I just did not feel good about that when you said that. And I said, well, it's true. I mean, it's just, that's the nature of the beast. That's the way the race is. So, you know, there were some things that didn't work positive going into Belmont, but, he came out of it, you know, he came out of it safe, and it was, as far as that goes, everybody's good.
Well, he ran basically a winning race. I'll never forget that as long as I live. I was sitting there, actually standing right near the wire in a box, and my future wife was with me, and Aaron Wellman, who's now the master of Eclipse Thoroughbreds, and we had gone down to watch him win the Triple Crown like everybody else. And Aaron says to me, who's that moving on the turn? And that's when I got that pit in my stomach. I said, that's Mrs. Whitney's horse. And, I mean, that was like the weirdest day. Everybody was screaming when he came into the stretch, and he looked like he was going to win the Triple Crown, something that everybody wanted so badly. And then when they hit the wire, the place turned into a morgue. I mean, you couldn't hear a pin drop. It went from total screaming to total silence. It was the freakiest day at the races that I ever had, and I will never forget it. But, you know, your horse ran his ass off. I mean, he was fantastic that
John,
day.
Have you ever seen a day or an event like a Grade One race where the winners of the race are almost apologetic that they won the race?
I know. Well, I think that was the desperateness of the industry. I think at the time, you know, everybody was really looking for a Triple Crown winner, and the industry sure could have used it. And then, you know, unfortunately, it didn't happen. And listen, you know, you're going out there to win. That's everybody's job, and nobody did anything different. Everybody did what they were supposed to do, and you know, it just didn't turn out well for us. But I'm the same way. When I was watching the race, I remember coming to the quarter pole, and I had my binoculars on my horse, and I scanned back, saw Birdstone really was the only horse running at that point. And I thought, oh, man, this horse, he needs to flatten out or hang or something. he's covering a lot of ground pretty quick.
Yeah.
Well, John, look, you handled that situation with class just as you have everything throughout your career, and your brother, just a tremendous team. We can't thank you enough for being a guest here on Trainer Talk tonight. We could have gone on for another half an hour, but Steve Hobby is up next, so we'll catch up the road, and we really appreciate you taking the time. And if you have folks that do want to tune in later, there will be a podcast available on our website at horseracingradio.net.
Can you do me a favor, because I haven't had an opportunity to talk to him? Can you be sure and tell Steve I should give my congratulations?
I will do.
And thank you guys very much. I enjoyed it.
John, great stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Service, classy guy, and somebody who did handle that Triple Crown run, the whole thing. I mean, just with absolute class.
A lot of pressure. It's a tough racket.
Yeah. Good stuff. John Service. We now turn our attention to Steve Hobby in the second half of the show. He burst in the spotlight. He's been in the spotlight several times throughout his career. He's won more than 1,000 races, earned win number 1,000 earlier this month on March 1st. We're going to talk to him about that, and we'll look back on that victory of Tismas Sioux this past weekend in the Azari. It's all ahead on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train.
You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train, it's time to get on board.
Group-winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at two with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a Group 1. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Montjou and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky, for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
How would you like to compete in a $50,000 online tournament with no fees, takeout, or rake? Sound impossible? Believe it! ExpressBet Live is a fairy tale come true for horse players. Starring at a knight in shining armor, $10,000 first prize. ExpressBet Live also offers $5,000 in cash to second, $2,500 to third, and $1,500 to fourth. Fifth through tenth place finishers earn $1,000 each. Plus, the top 30 finishers in ExpressBet Live earn seats in the $100,000 Express Bet Showdown, a $500 value each. Tournament registration is open and free to account holders only at ExpressBet.com. Visit ExpressBet.com today for tournament details, to open a no-fee account, and to register for ExpressBet Live. This is your golden opportunity to make a score in a tournament, especially designed to give horse players all the breaks. Don't miss it.
Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Problem Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
The road to the Kentucky Derby runs through Turfway Park for the Grade 3 Spiral Stakes. Join our Eclipse award-winning team Saturday, March 23rd, as we march closer to the first Saturday in May and the 139th Run for the Roses. Who will earn the points needed to get closer to their bid for the Kentucky Derby? Tune in to find out. The Spiral Stakes, Saturday on Sirius 93, or listen online at horseracingradio.net. This is HRRN, your exclusive home for Kentucky Derby 139.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. It is time to get on board the Bullet Train. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, back in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and a great visit in the first half of the show with trainer John Service. We now turn our attention to trainer Steve Hobby, who has really done just an amazing job throughout much of his career. He reached a career milestone on Friday, March 1st, saddling his 1,000th career winner when Ruthless Empire got the victory at Oaklawn Park. And his total now stands at 1,004 victories thanks to this performance by Tiz Miss Sue this past Saturday.
Tiz Miss Sue is in fourth. On the outside, Don't Tell Sophia, My Miss Aurelia, between them, Songs and Sonnets at the Rail. Tiz Miss Sue is running on willingly. It's turning into a thriller. Don't Tell Sophia takes the lead, has to hold off Tiz Miss Sue. Here comes Tiz Miss Sue after Don't Tell Sophia. Tiz Miss Sue takes the lead at the 16th pole, and Tiz Miss Sue is back as she beats Don't Tell Sophia. My Miss Aurelia checks in a well-beaten third.
Frank Miramati with the call, the Azari Stakes, Tiz Miss Sue successfully defending her title this past Saturday. Steve, does that ever get old?
No, never.
Well, congratulations on the big win, and congratulations on that milestone earlier this month as well.
Thank you very much. You think, a couple weeks so far.
Yeah, you think about 1,000 career victories, just a remarkable accomplishment. Did you ever think that you would get there? Be honest.
No, never. I mean, I never thought of any numbers like that at all. In fact, I had no idea it was even close to it until last November. I was at Churchill, and David Longinati from Oakland here called me and said, you know, don't win eight races this fall. You got to get it at Oakland. You're eight wins off 1,000. I said, you got to be kidding me. I had no idea. So,
well, that's always a nice surprise when you're at a milestone and you're so humble you don't even know it's happening to you.
I'm not paying attention. I don't know whether I'm
humility. By the way, you're so busy winning. John Service said to congratulate you. He said he hasn't had a chance to talk to you, but he was very happy.
Yeah. So, John's a good fella.
Talking with Steve Hobby here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Steve, when you build toward that 1,000th career victory, working toward a milestone like that, we hear athletes in sports all the time talk about how the pressure really does get to them and they start to kind of think about it a lot more. Was it actively on your mind after David called you and said, hey, you're that close?
Yeah, it was because it was coming into this meet at Oakland, which is home, and it's a really huge meet for all my people, you know, and most of my people are locals and they all come to the races, and you know, it's my favorite track, and you know, all those things made it bigger. If I was coming to it somewhere else, it probably wouldn't have made me as nervous, you know, but, I sure wanted to do it here.
Yeah, what was that moment like when you finally see Ruthless Empire cross the finish line and you go, wow, the pressure's off, I did it?
Right, oh yeah, it's a big relief, you know, and it worked out that my parents come once a year to visit up here, and they just happened to be here the day before, got here the night before, so they were here for it, so that made it really special.
And, of course, you continue that hot streak with Tiz Miss Sue this past weekend. Some mare. What a performance by her. Talk about that race.
You know, it was a great race. I mean, nice field for a grade three. And, you know, she just ran super. She seems to be, you know, so much more mature this year than she has been in the past. But, she's always been solid. I mean, you look at her form. She just is such a consistently solid, nice mare.
She had a lot of time between wins.
She did. It was more my fault than hers. You know, I matched her up pretty tough all the time the last few years.
You think that's what it was? It was the competition more than anything else?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, in the years past, we've had a little trouble with her rating. She gets a little rank early, and then if they have to fight her, she doesn't have quite the finish that she should have. And she's begun to – Joe's really got her figured out. So, you know, and him and her get along really well. And she just, with age, has gotten to where she's – relaxing so much better that hopefully if she'll continue to do that, you know, I heard she may have a little better chance to win.
Steve, you know, I'm curious. We talk to a lot of trainers here on this show and on the other broadcasts that we do, and they always strike me, trainers always strike me as being like coaches, where they take a lot of pride in the horses that they train, much like a coach would do in their players, and they tend to defend their players a little bit and, you know, defend their horses that they're training. Tiz Miss Sue, the defending champ, and I know My Miss Aurelia was in the field, but she's the defending champ for much of the wagering. She's on the tote board at double-digit odds. She goes off at 8-1. Is there a moment when you're walking over with her or you look at the tote board and you say, wow, I can't believe we're not getting the respect we deserve?
Yeah, she doesn't deserve that kind of a deal. Yeah, you do that. Yeah, and then you really want – that makes you even more so want to win, you know, to show them that they're wrong.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you. Does it fuel that fire inside of you and say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right?
Right.
Yeah, I know it does Wayne Lucas, because he always says, well, the press, they don't have a clue. They let this horse go at 20-1.
Yeah, I think it's more the public doing that than the press.
Well, Steve, that's kind of the present. That's where we are today. Let's go back to the beginning and talk about how you got started in the sport. I know this was somewhat in your pedigree. And a kid from Colorado, how's a kid from Colorado get involved in horse racing and train over 1,000 winners?
Well, there was a track where I'm from in Colorado, in Englewood. There was a track called Centennial that was just a few miles away from my parents' house. And then there was a place called Arapahoe County Fairgrounds where you could board horses and had a training track and everything. And my dad got to helping people out there when I was pretty young, and he got to exercise and race horses for some of those trainers. And then he graduated until he was training a few, and then he ended up, you know, taking over and training on his own. So I worked at the barn and, you know, started out, you know, walking hots and cleaning stalls and all that stuff like most people do, and then exercising horses. And I was a jockey for 4 years and outgrew that occupation. And then I started training quarter horses for a while. And I hooked up with a man named Rand Ricks out of Oklahoma, an old man out of Oklahoma, and went and spent 2 years running his farm there. Helped build his training center up in Oklahoma and ran that for 2 years. And then at the time, J.J. Pletcher, Todd's dad, was training for him. And then after the 2 years at the farm, I took over. And that's the same people that owned Tiz Miss Sue, so we've been together a long time.
Yeah, talk about that relationship. Pretty special, isn't it?
Yeah, it's neat. Mr. Ricks passed away about 11, 12 years ago, I guess. But Mrs. Carol, Mrs. Ricks, and her grandson, Rand, they're hanging right in there.
Steve, it's funny to hear you mention Centennial Park, because Bill Mott joined us on the show a couple of months ago, and he told us a story that there was a point in his career when he was just getting started that his horses weren't even good enough to get stalls at Centennial.
Yeah, that's true. It wasn't, you know, a Belmont Park or a Santa Anita, but it was, you know, it was along the lines of Exarban and, you know, like that back in those days. And like Don Von Himmel ran a lot there and some, you know, like that, but it was a really nice place. And Bill came from out of, I think, South Dakota or something, didn't he?
Yeah, Mobridge.
Yeah, that was really minor league where he started.
Every once in a while, I grew up in Southern California, and every once in a while, somebody'd ship a horse or two down from Centennial to run at Santa Anita, and they would just blow the Santa Anita horses away. I think it was because they were up so high and their lungs filled up.
Yep. There was a point, you know, that if you shipped from that altitude to a lower altitude, you had to run within a certain amount of time, and you had a huge advantage. And after a little bit of while, then it went just the other way until they got climated. You know, if you waited, like, I don't remember the time, it's been a long time ago, but like if you got in there and ran about 4 days, they would just have more air than you can believe. And then if you waited like 10 days, they'd stop terribly. And then if you wait, you know, then you needed to wait about 3 weeks just to get normal. But it did make a difference at my higher.
And Steve, you mentioned your career in the saddle. Talk about that and being a rider. How long did that career last? How many winners did you have? Do you remember?
I don't know how many winners I had. It was 4 years. I loved it. It's a great occupation, you know. I mean, it's thrilling. It's fun. I loved it. I was graduated high school, weighed 110 pounds, and then I just started growing. But I wouldn't trade, you know, for what I've had now. I mean, I told I have a new assistant that works for me that just quit being a jockey 2 years ago to go to work for me. And I told him, I said, you're not going to believe me, but there's going to be a time that you're going to get way bigger thrill out of winning from this side than the other side, because you spend months and months and hours of work, you know, trying to get this horse to a race and starting from scratch and all the things that go on at the barn to get one over there, as opposed to just walking out of the jock's room, getting on and riding. You know, I said, it takes both, but and he told me the other day, he said, boy, you were right. I just can't believe how much more fulfillment you get out of, you know, doing it from the other side.
In that vein, are you harder on jockeys after a race, or are you a little bit more understanding?
I think I'm probably easier to ride for because of my riding history, you know, because I know what it's like out there, and you have, so, you know, just minor seconds to make a decision. And you know, when you make the decision, sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong. You look like a genius when it's right. You look like an idiot when it's wrong. And you can make the same decision 10 times and 5 times wrong, 5 times right. You know, it just depends on whatever, you know, what the other guys do. You know, you can't read the minds of the guy ahead of you. You try to, but this guy looks like he's going to go right, so you go left and he goes left, and, you know, things like that. I think I'm fairly easy to ride for.
Steve, who was the first winner that you ever rode, and what was that horse's name?
It was a filly named Lana Lynn. It was in Grand Junction, Colorado. My dad was the trainer.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's really neat. What was I'm sure your dad was absolutely thrilled giving you the leg up. Did he have any instructions for you before
the
race?
By the way, my dad's a steward now. Has been for several years now. He quit training, now he's a steward.
Do you remember, did he give you any instructions before that race when he gave you the leg up?
Oh, he probably did. But with quarter horses, there aren't a lot of instructions with quarter horses. Just go.
Yeah.
Get out of the gate and go.
Don't get left.
Yeah, right.
Talk about that relationship with your dad. Obviously, a former trainer, now a steward. Are there things that he taught you along the way that you still incorporate into your operation today?
Oh, yeah. I'm a lot. Just basic horsemanship. Just, you know, watching horses, paying attention to horses. You know, just, you know, when they're doing right and when they're not. Just, you know, just basic grassroots horsemanship.
Was he one of the first people that, you said he was there when you won your 1,000th career milestone? That had to be pretty neat.
It was really neat. Him and Mom were both here, and they just got here the night before. It was like we planned it. And it was really funny because they always come about 2 weeks later than they did this year, and it had nothing to do with this. It was just when they planned their trip, you know. So that made it, you know, it was neat.
Timing is everything.
Yeah, exactly. Luck. A little luck out of there.
Your wife is also involved with your operation, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's always been very involved. She's worked with me for all these years.
Did you meet on the racetrack?
Pretty much, sort of. You know, that training center I told you about that was, you know, near Centennial, where we boarded horses and they had a training track. That's where we went.
So you've been together a long time.
Yeah, I think our first day I was 16 and she was 15.
Wow.
I'm curious to know that, how that dynamic actually works, Steve, because my wife and I will not work together. We love each other to death, but, you know, we will not work together.
I'll tell you, we're very fortunate in that way. You know, that because a lot of people can't do that, live together and work together. We've never had any problems. But she said a long time ago, I got to give her all the credit for this, because she said a long time ago, she said, I realize there can only be one boss. And so she gets to be the boss at the house, and I get to be the boss at the barn, which is pretty good.
That's great. Good system.
Talking with trainer Steve Hobby here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train. It is the show that trainers listen to. And Steve, as I mentioned, recording that milestone 1,000 victory back on March 1st. And now, of course, standing at 1,004 victories thanks to Tismas Sue's victory in the Azari Stakes this past weekend. Steve, outside of Tismas Sue, I know she's obviously meant an awful lot to you. Talk about some of the other horses that you've been around throughout the years that have really had an impact on your career.
Well, probably the number one, Chindi, who's my stable pony now. He's 18 years old. He made over $1 million, and he just took me all over the country. He was a sprinter, but just the neatest horse, you know, and raced 9 years, and just, you know, like I said, he took me everywhere. So, you know, I got to go all over taking him around. You get to be, you know, much more well-known that way. He's as famous as I am around here. I mean, everybody asked me how's Chindi before they asked how I'm doing. And then Talene, of course, that won the Sword Dancer Saratoga 2 years in a row. And he's now standing in Florida. And then Sue's mother, Sue's Good News, was a really nice filly, graded stakes winner. And then I had a couple Oklahoma breds that were very, very nice horses named Brush with Pride and Belle of Cosine, both graded stakes winners that made quite a bit of money. So I've been fortunate. It's nice. You just got to have one in your barn all the time to keep you going. You know, as long as you got that one big horse in the barn, it kind of keeps you getting up every day.
Yeah, and of course, Chindi, owned by Cressran, and they are the same owners of Tismas Sioux, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, just a tremendous story and a great relationship there. And Telling, you talked about Telling, owned by longtime owners Alex and Joanne Lieblong. Talk about training for Alex and Joanne, and talk about that run that you had with Telling, because it was spectacular.
Oh, they're great. I've been really lucky that we hooked up. Alex spend a lot of money buying horses at the sales and everything, where the Cressran is more of a breeder. Lieblongs are more buyers, which works out great for me. Alex and her, they're looking for a good horse. I mean, their big goal is to try and get a big horse. And we kind of backed into Telling. And but it just doesn't matter how you get him as long as you get him, right?
That's right.
And he was just a late bloomer. And it was fun. You know, the thrill of winning a grade one at Saratoga is just words can't describe. For those of us that don't get that many opportunities to do it, it's huge. You know, it's just... like that. The first time, our daughter was in between jobs right then, so she took off some time and went with her mother. And so my wife and her hauled him up there, and my wife was a groom. My daughter was a hot walker. I came in, one of my best friends, Ralph Nix, galloping for me, and then I came up. It was a total family affair, so it was just really a blast.
Yeah, that's cool when everybody gets involved.
It was really fun. Yeah.
What about a horse that you did some good work with that other people don't know about? A horse that's maybe not so famous that you're pretty proud of what you did with him?
Oh, wow. That's a good question.
You can toot your own horn. It's okay.
Yeah, right. Wow. That's
well, we always hear about the, the horses that won stakes and all that. But I know, being a former trainer, I know what it's like. Sometimes you get a horse that maybe has legs at right angles or, is a real hard horse to train that other people don't know about, but you're pretty proud of.
Yeah. I'm sure there's somebody, and you got me stumped right now.
All right. That's okay.
I'm curious. I want to know your operation. I mean, you talk about Chindi, and you talk about being the, an outstanding sprinter the way he was. I mean, the Count Fleet sprint handicap being one of his many, many wins down there at Oaklawn Park. And you talk about Telling, who was a turf marathoner. And then you talk about Tismas Sioux, who is a really, really nice distaffer and does well on the main track. And then you've had young horses like June Bug Red that excel earlier in their career. What is it about your operation that has allowed you to have so much success with so many different types of horses? That's a little bit unusual.
Well, mostly, if you'll notice, you didn't mention very many two-year-olds. None of my people push me to run two-year-olds, and we kind of take our time and try and have something left when they get a little older. And, I think that it really works. You just got to be patient and give them the horses the time to develop and show you what direction they want to go. I think that's the biggest thing. But again, that's having good patient owners that will let you give the horse the time to tell you. I don't think you make that horse into a sprinter. You make that horse into a distance horse. That's what they are. You just got to follow what they tell you. That's what they want to be.
And Oaklawn Park, obviously the place where you earned that milestone victory, and so many of your career wins have come there in Hot Springs. Why is that such a special place, especially to you, Steve?
Well, we've made this our home. We just love it here. It's just a great, great town. And I don't know if you've ever been here, but the enthusiasm at the races is second to none. I mean, maybe Saratoga, but otherwise everybody here just loves the races. They come out to watch, they come down to the paddock and watch the saddle. They go out in the apron and watch the horses warm up and they ride them up in the paper every day. And it's just you really feel like you're appreciated when you put on the show here. And that's so rare at other tracks anymore, I hate to say, but with the casinos and everything everywhere else, it's just not as, people aren't just as into it as they are here. And it's a great feeling to be here.
Yeah, it's like an event. I remember the first time I went there, I ran a horse in the Razorback many years ago, And I was so impressed. We went out to dinner, and they brought that green sheet around with the charts of the races in it.
Exactly.
I go, this is the greatest place I've ever been.
Right, right. And you'd be sitting at dinner, and they'd come around there with that green sheet and bring you all the results and everything.
Yeah.
That's, you're going back a long ways, but I remember that, too. Yeah,
yeah, that was cool.
Steve, what's your favorite Oaklawn hangout?
My favorite Oaklawn hangout, as far as like a bar?
Yeah, or... well, a restaurant. Well, yeah, sure, bar, wherever. We'll meet you there.
Well, my favorite place to eat in town is the Back Porch Grill. And I don't really have a favorite. I used to have a real favorite bar here called Johnny's, but it closed down, so I guess we really don't have one anymore.
What does Steve Hobby do? Here you go. What are some of your hobbies outside of horse racing? What would you do in your off time?
My big joke, everybody needs a hobby.
That's a great slogan.
Yeah. I love skeet shooting and sporting clays. We do some of that. I'm at the gym right now as we speak. I like to work out and run. I like to run. And, you know, with horse racing, you don't get allowed a lot of extra time. I'm not a golfer. So, and thank God I'm not a roper, because those two things seem to take up all your time.
You're not running now while you're doing the interview, though, right? Because you're in pretty good shape if you are.
Actually, I just got done. I'm just sitting out here.
You're not even breathing hard. You cooled out well.
We can run you back in a week.
Yeah.
Do you do marathons and all that kind of stuff too?
I've never done a marathon. I do it just more for myself, and I like to get away. It's my time for me, you know. And when the weather's nice and I can run, you know, some trails and things like that, it's really, really enjoyable. I used to worry about the time and how far I went and everything. And a girl told me, she said, "Oh, you're ruining it by doing all that. You've got as much pressure on your running as you do on your work." And I thought, boy, is that not intelligent? Because I'm trying to do this to relax, and here I am stressing myself out trying to go faster and further. So I quit carrying a watch, and I don't look at it, you know. No, watch. I just go run till I stop.
A recreational runner.
Better than others. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been my philosophy with golf now, too. I just bring a box of balls with me every round, and when they're gone, they're gone. That's it. I usually get through 9 holes.
Sometimes you don't.
Well, Steve, look, it's been a magical ride for you. What does the future hold here for Steve Hobby? What can we look forward to?
Well, I think the future's, you know, very strong. I mean, like Tismas Susie, looking like she's on, you know, going to come back for the next season. I've got some really nice three-year-olds for the Leblongs. Big Lute, unfortunately, who looks like the star, got a little knee problem. He's having surgery today, actually. But it's minor, and the prognosis is excellent, so hopefully we'll have him back soon. I got For Greater Glory running in the Spiral on Saturday at Turfway. And I think I've got the best-looking two-year-olds I've ever had coming, so we'll see. That remains to be seen, but, you know, it keeps you from committing suicide when you got nice babies coming.
Well, yeah, we don't want you to do that. Let's keep those babies coming to Steve Hobby. Everybody needs a hobby. Steve, are you going to be here at Turfway this weekend then?
Yes, I am. Leblons and I and Robbie, Alberto's flying, we're all flying up Saturday morning.
Oh, good. Okay, we'll be there. We're broadcasting that race on the radio Saturday afternoon.
I got Philly in the Bourbonette, too, Marathon Lady.
Oh, good. It'll be a fun afternoon.
Let's hope so.
Mortal Lock, can we go ahead and get down on him?
I know one thing. It could be a long flight home with all of us in that place.
That's right.
It'd be a fun flight home. It was a good day. You
know? Is it a private plane?
Yeah.
That makes it worse. It there's no place to escape.
I flew in commercial to Saratoga for the first sword dance, and we celebrated after the race too much, and I missed my flight back. So and I needed to be back in Chicago that night. I had Tismas Sue running in the Arlington Futurity, the girls' end. I forgot what they called Lassie.
Yeah.
The next day, So Mr. Leblong, he had his plane there, his jet. He said, "Well, I'd make a deal with you. Every time you win me a grade one, I'll fly you home in my plane." So he flew me back that night. But that was a fun flight. You know, won, so.
Yeah, that's always good.
That's not a bad deal.
Where are you going to be based this summer?
Churchill,
okay.
Well, Steve, we really appreciate being with us. We're going to let you go in just a minute, but just spend just a minute or two talking about those horses running this weekend on that Turfway card, because, again, we're going to be there. We can't wait to say hello to you and learn more about those horses. So tell us a little bit more about each one.
For greater glory, he had a really, really nice work at Ocala on the synthetic when he was in the two-year-old sale. But now that we've never had him on it since then, man, he's run real well. You know, all his races have been excellent. And but we thought, you know, trying to split him and Big Buddha up, and since he had that good work and, you know, the spirals were so much money, I said, let's send him up to Turfway for that last race, you know, and see how he handles the synthetic. Well, he had a horrible trip. He got away bad. He got hit in the turn. He got shut off two or three times in the stretch. I mean, it was just an awful trip, and he ran third and got beat like a length and a quarter. So, you know, that was sure promising. You know, I really felt like, you know, he had just the trip from hell, and so we decided we'd go back and try the big money. Now, there's a really good horse on Mark Cassie's going in there, but for that much money, you don't mind taking on a monster. He's just training outstanding. So Robbie won on him here, so he knows him, and he's agreed to go riding. And then the filly, Broker Maiden here the other day real easily with Robbie on her as well. She also had a really good work at the two-year-old sale in Ocala and has not been on the synthetic since. So we thought, well, we were going with him. And again, there's another big monster in there, Kenny McPeaks. But we thought, while we're going, we might as well take both of them.
Well, Steve, we really appreciate you spending some time with us here tonight, and we can't thank you enough for that. And safe travels up to Turfway. Good luck with those horses, and good luck on your way to your next milestone. Really enjoyed the visit.
Thank you, guys.
All right, take it easy.
All right, trainer Steve Hobby, rounding out trainer talk here on this Wednesday evening. And fun guy, huh?
Yeah, that was great.
So let's see. So we've had David Fox do trainer talk with us from a boat off of the Keys during a fishing trip.
Right.
He spent a half an hour with us. Steve Hobby was at the gym.
Right. We've had a couple trainers be driving somewhere from racetrack to racetrack.
Yeah, I think Kelly Breen was on his way to a Florida Panthers hockey game, wasn't he?
Yeah.
wasn't that?
Hey, you got to get them when you can get them, you know?
Yeah, it's nice that these guys do take the time for us, and these ladies, I should say, because we've had a couple of female trainers want to do more of that as well, and maybe Linda Rice. I think she'd be really good to have on the show at some point
soon. It'd be great to talk to her.
Yeah. But really enjoyed the visit here tonight with John Service, with Steve Hobby. If you did miss any portion of Trainer Talk tonight, you can go back to our website later on. There will be a podcast available right there on our homepage at horseracingradio.net. And, of course, you can check out podcasts of all of our Trainer Talk shows. They are available under the Trainer Talk tab on the right-hand side of the homepage. Just click on that, and it'll take you to the Trainer Talk page, and you can listen to all of our shows at your leisure and, of course, on iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes.
Yeah, I don't like to say it because we do it, but they're pretty fascinating. I love listening to the trainers talk about their lives and how they got in the game and what drives their passion for the sport. So they're well worth listening to.
Yeah, and I think, to me, the most fascinating thing, now, you know, you've been there. You've been a trainer. You've been down that road. So for me, coming to it from a totally outside perspective and hearing the stories of how people got into the game, because trainers come from everywhere. You know,
right.
They come from being a former rider. They come from just coming to the States like Rudy Rodriguez did, right? Just came from Mexico and just, you know, didn't even intend to be a trainer and just kind of fell into it. Other people, their parents were in it, like John Service, and grew up around it and just wanted to be part of it. And
right.
Then for other people, they leave.
Well, Jeff,
you know,
Greenhill,
jobs.
He was a physicist or something.
Yeah,
right?
Left a six-figure job, took the early retirement,
hello?
And here he is on the Derby Trail with Mac the Man. So
yeah. No, it's fascinating. And, you know, it seems like these shows that we do, there's always a thread that runs through them. And today, both of the guys we had on, their fathers are stewards, which you know, that was a new one for Trainer Talk. And it's not like we plan this stuff, but we do find out that, you know, like a lot of trainers have worked for Jack Vanberg or whatever. It seems like there's a lot of different common threads, but there's a huge diversity as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. Don't forget this show tomorrow night, in terms of the final Furlong show from 6 to 7 Eastern time, is our Brisnet.com call-in show presented by Twin Spires. Your opportunity to call into the show and talk some racing with us. Again, that's 6 to 7 Eastern. But we are here with you Thursday afternoon from 3 to 7. We'll be here with our live race coverage from 3 to 6. And then, of course, that Brisnet.com call-in show from 6 to 7. And on Friday, the race coverage from 3 to 6 and 6 to 7, our Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview. Had a lot of people tweeting to us and emailing us last week because Ellis Starr and JT gave out quite a few winners. They were on a roll, so
Yeah, we had a good day. It was nice.
All right, well, it's a lot to look forward to over the next couple of days, of course, all leading up to our coverage of the Spiral Stakes as we continue to take you down that road to Kentucky Derby 139 as your official home for the Kentucky Derby on radio. The only place you'll hear it on radio coast to coast is with us. You can see a complete schedule at horseracingradio.net. Our thanks to John Service and Steve Hoppe for joining us tonight on Trainer Talk. For Lee Delapina, our producer, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Good night, Barbados.